Chapter 4. Friday, April 29th. While Chris waited in the hall outside the bedroom, Dr. Klein and a noted neuropsychiatrist were intently examining Reagan, observing her for almost half an hour, flinging, whirling, tearing at the hair and occasionally grimacing and pressing her hands against her ears as if blotting out a sudden and deafening noise. She bellowed obscenities, screamed in pain. Then at last she flung herself face downward onto the bed and, tucking her legs up under her stomach, she began to moan softly and incoherently. The psychiatrist motioned Klein to come over to him. "Let's get her tranquilized," he whispered. "Maybe I can talk to her." The internist nodded and prepared an injection of 50 milligrams of Thorazine. However, when the doctors approached the bed, Reagan seemed to sense their presence and quickly turned over, and as the neuropsychiatrist attempted to hold her, she shrieked in malevolent fury, bit him, fought him, held him off. It was only when Carl was called in to assist that they managed to keep Reagan sufficiently still for Klein to be able to administer the injection. The dosage proved inadequate, and another 50 milligrams was injected. Then they waited, and soon Reagan grew tractable, then dreamy, then stared at the doctors in sudden bewilderment. "Where's Mom? I want Mom." She was tearful and frightened. At a nod from the neuropsychiatrist, Klein left the room. "Your mother will be here in just a second, dear," the psychiatrist said to Reagan soothingly. He sat on the bed and stroked her head. "There, there, it's all right, dear. I'm a doctor."
"I want my mom."
"Your mom is coming. She's coming. Or do you hurt, dear?" As the tears streamed down her face, Reagan nodded. "Tell me where, dear. Where does it hurt?"
"It hurts every place. Oh, my baby. Mom!"
Chris ran to the bed and hugged her, kissed her, comforted and soothed. Then Chris herself became tearful, but with happiness.
"Oh, your back, Rags. Your back. It's really you." "Oh, Mom, he hurt me," Reagan told her, sniffling. "Please make him stop hurting me. Okay, Mom, please?"
Chris stared at her, puzzled, then turned to the doctors with a plea and a question in her eyes as she asked them, "What? What is it?" "She's heavily sedated," the psychiatrist said gently.
"You mean that?"
He quickly cut her off with, "We'll see." The psychiatrist turned to Reagan. "Can you tell me what's wrong, dear?"
"I don't know,"
Reagan tearfully answered him.
"I don't know. I don't know why he does it. He was always my friend before."
"Who's that?"
"Captain Howdy. And then after, it's like somebody else is inside me, making me do things."
"Captain Howdy?"
"I don't know."
"A person?" Reagan nodded. "Tell me who."
"I don't know."
"Well, all right, then. Let's try something, Reagan. How about if we play a little game?" He was reaching into a jacket pocket and drew out a shining round bauble attached to a silvery length of chain. "Have you ever seen movies where someone gets hypnotized?" he asked. Wide-eyed, Reagan solemnly nodded. "Well, I'm a hypnotist, Reagan." "Oh, yes, really. I hypnotize people all the time. I really do." "That's, of course, if they let me. Now, I think if I hypnotize you, Reagan, it will help you get well." "Yep. That person inside you will come right out."
"Would you like to be hypnotized? See, your mother's right here. She's right beside you."
Reagan looked at Chris questioningly. "Go ahead, honey. Do it," Chris urged her.
Try it.
Reagan turned to the psychiatrist and nodded.
Okay, she said softly. But only a little.
The psychiatrist smiled, then quickly glanced to the sound of pottery breaking behind him. A delicate vase had fallen to the floor from the top of a bureau where Klein was now resting his forearm. He looked at his arm and then down at the shards with an air of puzzlement, then stooped to pick them up.
Never mind, Doc. Willie'll get it, Chris told him.
Would you please close those shutters for me, Sam? The psychiatrist asked. And pull the drapes?
When the room was dark, the psychiatrist gripped the chain in his fingertips and began to swing the bauble back and forth with an easy movement. He shone a penlight on it. It glowed. He began to intone the hypnotic ritual. Now watch this, Reagan. Keep watching, and soon you'll feel your eyelids growing heavier and heavier.
Within a very short time, Reagan seemed to be in a trance.
Extremely suggestible, the psychiatrist murmured. Then he asked, Are you comfortable, Reagan?
Yes,
Reagan answered, in a voice that was soft and whispery.
How old are you, Reagan? 12.
Is there someone inside you?
Sometimes.
When?
Different times.
It's a person?
Yes.
Who is it?
I don't know.
Captain Howdy?
I don't know.
A man?
I don't know.
But he's there.
Yes. Sometimes.
Now?
I don't know.
If I ask him to tell me, would you let him answer?
No!
Why not?
I'm afraid.
Afraid of what?
I don't know.
If he talks to me, Reagan, I think he will leave you. Do you want him to leave you?
Yes.
Let him speak, then. Would you let him speak?
A long silence, and then finally, Yes.
I am speaking to the person inside of Reagan now, the psychiatrist said firmly. If you are there, you too are hypnotized and must answer all my questions.
For a moment, he allowed the suggestion to enter Reagan's bloodstream. Then he repeated it.
If you are there, then you are hypnotized and must answer all my questions. Come forward and answer me now. Are you there? Silence.
Then something curious happened. Reagan's breath turned suddenly foul. It was thick like a current. The psychiatrist smelled it from 2 feet away. He shone the penlight on Reagan's face, and wide-eyed and shocked, Chris lifted a hand to stifle a gasp as she watched Reagan's features contort into a malevolent mask, her lips pulling tautly in opposite directions and the tumefied tongue lolling wolfishly from her mouth.
Are you the person in Reagan? Asked the psychiatrist. Reagan nodded.
Who are you?
Now on my, she answered gutturally. That's your name? Another nod. You're a man? She said. Say.
Did you answer?
Say.
If that's yes, nod your head.
Reagan nodded. Are you speaking in a foreign language? Say.
Where do you come from?
Dog. You say that you come from a dog? Dog morphosion, Reagan replied.
The psychiatrist paused, and after thinking it over, he decided to attempt another approach.
When I ask you questions now, Reagan, you will answer by moving your head. A nod for yes and a shake for no. Do you understand that?
Reagan nodded.
Did your answers have meaning? He asked her.
Yes.
Are you someone whom Reagan has known?
No.
That she knows of?
No.
Are you someone she's invented?
No.
You're real?
Yes.
Part of Reagan?
No.
Were you ever a part of Reagan?
No.
Do you like Reagan?
No.
Dislike her?
Yes.
Do you hate her?
Yes.
Over something she's done?
Yes.
Do you blame her for her parents' divorce?
No.
Has it something to do with her parents?
No.
With a friend?
No.
But you hate her?
Yes.
Are you punishing Reagan?
Yes.
You wish to harm her?
Yes.
To kill her?
Yes.
If she died, wouldn't you die too?
No.
The answer seemed to disquiet him, and he lowered his eyes in thought. The bed springs squeaked as he shifted his weight. In the smothering stillness, Reagan's breathing came raspy, as if from a rotted, putrid bellows. Here, yet far, and sinister. As he lifted his glance again to that hideous, twisted face, the psychiatrist's eyes gleamed sharply with speculation as he asked, "Is there something she can do that would make you leave her?"
"Yes."
"Can you tell me what it is?"
"Yes."
"Will you tell me?"
"No."
"But you..." Abruptly, the psychiatrist gasped in pain as he realized with horrified incredulity that Reagan was squeezing his scrotum with the hand that had gripped him like an iron talon. Eyes wide and staring, he struggled to free himself, but he couldn't. "Sam! Sam, help me!" he croaked in agony. Bedlam. Chris leaping for the light switch. Dr. Klein running forward. Reagan with her head back, cackling demonically, then howling like a wolf. Chris slapped at the light switch. Then she turned and saw flickering, grainy black-and-white film of a slow-motion nightmare. Reagan and the doctors writhing on the bed in a tangle of shifting arms and legs, in a melee of grimaces, gasps, and curses, and the howling and the yelping and the hideous laughter. Reagan oinking and grunting like a pig, Reagan neighing like a horse, and then the film running faster with the bedstead shaking and violently quivering from side to side as Reagan's eyes rolled upward into their sockets as she wrenched up a keening shriek of terror, torn raw and bloody from the base of her spine. Reagan crumpled and fell unconscious. Something unspeakable left the room. For a haunted space of time, no one moved. Then slowly and carefully, the doctors untangled themselves. They stood up and stared at Reagan, speechless. And then Klein, expressionless, moved to the bed, took Reagan's pulse, and, satisfied, slowly and gently pulled her blanket up over her, and then nodded to Chris and the psychiatrist. They left the room and went down to the study, where, for a time, no one spoke. Chris was on the sofa with Klein, and the psychiatrist near her in the facing chairs that bracketed the space. The psychiatrist was pensive, pinching at his lip as he stared at the coffee table dully, then finally sighed and looked up at Chris as she turned her burned-out gaze to his. "What the hell is going on?" she asked in a haggard, vanquished whisper. "Did you recognize the language he was speaking?" Chris shook her head. Have you any religious beliefs?
No, I don't.
And your daughter?
No.
From there, the psychiatrist asked a lengthy series of questions relating to Reagan's psychological history. And when at last he had finished, he seemed disturbed.
What is it? Chris asked him,
her white-knuckled fingers clenching and unclenching on the balled-up handkerchief in her fist.
Doc, what has she got?
The psychiatrist looked evasive. Well, it's somewhat confusing, he said. And quite frankly, it would be quite irresponsible for me to attempt a diagnosis after so brief an examination.
Well, you must have some idea, Chris insisted.
Fingering his brow and looking down, the psychiatrist emitted a sigh, and then, relenting, looked up and said, All right, I know you're quite anxious, so I'll mention a couple of impressions, but they're tentative, okay? Chris leaned forward, nodding tensely.
Yeah, okay. So what are they?
Fingers in her lap started fumbling with the handkerchief, telling the stitches in the hem like linen rosary beads. To begin with, the psychiatrist told her, it's highly improbable that she's faking. Right, Sam? Klein was nodding in agreement. We think so for a number of reasons, the psychiatrist continued. For example, the abnormal and painful contractions, and most dramatically, I'd suppose, from the change in her features when we were talking to the so-called person she thinks is inside her. A psychic effect like that is unlikely, unless she believed in this person. Do you follow, ma'am?
Yeah, I guess. Except one thing I don't understand is where this other person comes from. I mean, you keep hearing about split personality, but I've never really known any explanation.
Well, neither does anyone else. We use concepts like consciousness and mind and personality, but we don't really know yet what they are. And so when I start talking about something like multiple or split personality, all we have are some theories that raise more questions than they give answers. Freud thought that certain ideas and feelings are somehow repressed by the conscious mind, and they remain alive in a person's subconscious, you see. They remain quite strong, in fact, and they continue to seek expression through various psychiatric symptoms. Now, when this repressed, let's call it dissociated material, the word dissociation here implying a splitting off from the mainstream of consciousness. Are you with me?
Yeah, go on.
All right. Well, when this type of material is sufficiently strong, or when the subject's personality is disorganized and weak, the result can be schizophrenic psychosis. Now, that isn't the same, he cautioned, as dual personality. Schizophrenia means a shattering of the personality. But where the dissociated material is strong enough to somehow come glued together, to somehow organize in the individual's subconscious, why then it's been known at times to function independently as a separate personality. In other words, to take over the bodily functions.
And that's what you think is happening to Reagan?
Well, that's just one theory. There are several others, some of them involving the notion of escape into unawareness, escape from some conflict or emotional problem. Your daughter hasn't any history of schizophrenia, and the EEG didn't show the brainwave pattern that normally accompanies it. So that leaves us with the general field of hysteria.
I gave last week, Chris murmured.
The worried psychiatrist smiled thinly. Hysteria, he continued, is a form of neurosis in which emotional disturbances are converted into bodily disorders. Now, in certain of its forms, there is dissociation, In psychasthenia, for example, the individual loses consciousness of his actions, but he sees himself act and attributes his actions to someone else. His idea of the second personality is quite vague, however, and Reagan seems quite specific. So we come to what Freud used to call the conversion form of hysteria, which grows from unconscious feelings of guilt, the need to be punished. Dissociation is the paramount feature here, even multiple personality. And the syndrome might also include epileptoid-like convulsions, hallucinations, and abnormal motor excitement. Chris had listened intently, her eyes and face scrunched up with the strain of trying to understand. "Well, that does sound a lot like Reagan," she said. "Don't you think? I mean, except for the guilt part. I mean, what would she have to feel guilty about?" Well, a cliche answer might be the divorce. Children often feel they are the ones rejected and sometimes assume the full responsibility for the departure of one of their parents. So in the case of your daughter, yeah, that might apply. Here I'm thinking of the symptoms of thanatophobia. That's a brooding and neurotic depression over the notion of people dying. Chris's stare grew intense. "In children," the psychiatrist continued, "you find it accompanied by guilt formation that's related to family stress, very often the fear of the loss of a parent. It produces rage and intense frustration. In addition, the guilt in this type of hysteria needn't be known to the conscious mind. It could even be the guilt that we call free-floating, which means it relates to nothing in particular. So this fear of death thing?" "The thanatophobia." "Yeah, right, what you said. Is it something that's inherited?" Looking slightly aside to avoid betraying his curiosity about the question, the psychiatrist said, No, I don't think so." Chris lowered her head and shook it. "I just don't get it," she said. "I'm confused." She looked up, gentle furrows lightly lining her brow. "I mean, where does this new personality come in?" "As I said, I don't know." The psychiatrist seemed to be choosing his words as carefully as flat round stones to skim over a pond. "It's fairly extraordinary for a child of her age to be able to pull together and organize the components of a new personality. And certain, well, there are some other things that are puzzling. Her performance with the Ouija board, for example, would indicate extreme suggestibility. Yet apparently, I never really hypnotized her." He shrugged. "Maybe she resisted. But the really striking thing," he noted, "is the new personality's apparent precocity. It isn't a 12-year-old at all. It's much older. And then there's the language she was speaking." His voice trailed off as he stared into the fireplace pensively. "There's a similar state, of course, but we don't know very much about it." "Oh? What's that?" The psychiatrist turned to her. "Well, it's a form of somnambulism where the subject suddenly manifests knowledge or skills that he's never learned, and where the intention of the second personality is to..." He broke off. "Well, it's terribly complicated," he resumed, "and I've oversimplified outrageously." He had also not completed his statement for fear of unduly upsetting Chris. "The intention of the second personality," he would have said, "was the destruction of the first." "And so, what's the bottom line?" "A bit squiggly, ma'am. She needs an intensive examination by a team of specialists. 2 or 3 weeks of really concentrated study in a clinical atmosphere. Someplace, like the Barringer Clinic in Dayton. Chris turned away, looking down. That's a problem? The psychiatrist asked her. Chris shook her head and said softly and morosely, No, I just lost hope. That's all. I didn't get you. Long story. The psychiatrist telephoned the Barringer Clinic. They agreed to take Reagan the following day. The doctors left. Chris swallowed the ache of remembrance of Dennings, thought again about death and the worm and the void and the unspeakable loneliness, the stillness and the silence and the darkness that awaited beneath the sod. No movement, no breathing, nothing. It's too much. It's too much. Chris lowered her head and briefly wept, and then put it away. Packing for the trip, Chris was standing in her bedroom, selecting a camouflaging wig to wear in Dayton, when Carl appeared at the open door. There was someone to see her, he told her. Who, Carl?
Detective.
Detective? He wants to see me?
Yes, madam.
Carl entered and handed Chris a business card. William F. Kinderman, it announced. Lieutenant of Detectives. The words were printed in an ornate, raised Tudor typeface that might have been selected by a dealer in antiques. Tucked in a corner, like a poor relation, were the smaller words, Homicide Division. Chris looked up at Carl with a tight-eyed suspicion. Carl, has he got something with him that might be a script? You know, a big manila envelope or something? There was no one in the world, Chris had come to discover, who didn't have a novel or a script or a notion for one or both tucked away in a drawer or a mental sock. She seemed to attract them as strongly as priests attracted derelicts and drunks. Carl shook his head. No, madam. Detective. Was it something to do with Burke? Chris found him sagging in the entry hall, the brim of his limp and crumpled hat clutched with short, fat fingers whose nails had the shine of a recent manicure. Plumpish, in his early 60s, he had jowly cheeks that gleamed of soap. He wore rumpled trousers, cuffed and baggy, beneath an oversized gray tweed overcoat that hung long and loose and old-fashioned. As Chris approached him, the detective told her, in a hoarsely emphysematous, whispery voice, I'd know that face in any lineup, Miss McNeil. Am I in one? Chris asked. Oh, my goodness. Oh, no. No, of course not. No, it's strictly routine, he assured her. Look, you're busy, then tomorrow. Yes, I'll come again tomorrow. He was turning away as if to leave when Chris said anxiously, What is it? Is it Burke? Burke Dennings? The detective's loose and careless ease had somehow tightened the springs of her tension. He turned and came back to her, dolefully staring with moist brown eyes that drooped at the corners and seemed perpetually staring at times gone by. Oh, what a terrible shame, he said.
A shame.
Was he killed? Chris asked him bluntly. I mean, you're a homicide cop. Is that why you're here? Burke was killed?
No.
As I told you, it's routine. Please, the detective repeated. You know, a man so important, we just couldn't pass it. We couldn't, he repeated with a helpless look and a shrug. At least one or two questions. Did he fall? Was he pushed? As he asked, he was listing from side to side with his head and an uplifted hand, palm outward. Then he shrugged and whispered huskily, Who knows? Was he robbed? No, not robbed, Miss McNeil. Never robbed. But then who needs a motive in times like these? The detective's hands were constantly in motion, like flabby gloves informed by the fingers of a bored puppeteer. Why, today, for a murderer, a motive's an encumbrance, maybe even a deterrent. He shook his head. These drugs, he bemoaned. All these drugs. He tapped at his chest with the tips of his fingers. Believe me, I'm a father,
And when I see what's going on, it breaks my heart. It does. You've got children?
Yes, one.
Son or daughter?
A daughter.
Oh, God bless her. Look, come on into the study, Chris told him as she turned to lead the way. Intensely anxious to hear what it was he had to say about Dennings.
Oh, Miss McNeil, could I trouble you for something?
Chris stopped and turned to face him with the dim and weary expectation that he wanted her autograph for his children. It was never for themselves. It was always for their children.
Yes, yeah, sure, she said amiably, in an effort to mask her impatience.
The detective gestured with a trace of a grimace.
My stomach, he said.
Do you keep maybe any calcium water? If it's trouble, never mind.
No
trouble at all, Chris answered with a faint, tight smile. Grab a chair in the study. Chris pointed, then turned and headed for the kitchen. I think there's a bottle in the fridge, she said.
Oh, come to the kitchen, the detective said, following with a gait that bordered on a waddle. Yes, I hate to be a bother.
It's no bother.
No, really, you're busy. I'll come.
You've got children? The detective asked as they walked.
Oh, no, that's right, he immediately corrected himself. Yes, a daughter, you told me. That's right, just the one.
And how old is she?
She just turned 12, said Chris. Ah, then you don't have to worry. No, not yet. Later on, though, watch out. He was shaking his head. When you see all the sickness day in and day out, unbelievable, incredible, insane. You know, I looked at my wife just a couple of days ago, or maybe weeks, I forget. I said, Mary, the world, the entire world, he had lifted his hands in a global gesture, is having a massive, nervous breakdown.
They had entered the kitchen where Carl was cleaning and polishing the interior of an oven. He neither turned nor acknowledged their presence.
This is really so embarrassing, the detective wheezed as Chris opened a refrigerator door.
And yet his gaze was on Carl, brushing swiftly and questioningly over the back of the manservant's head, like a small dark bird skimming low above a lake.
I meet a famous motion picture star, he continued, and I ask for some calcio water. It's a joke.
Chris had found the bottle and was looking for an opener. She said, ice? Oh, no, plain. Plain is fine. Chris opened the bottle, found a glass, and poured bubbly calcio water into it.
Ah, you know that film you made called Angel? The detective mentioned with a faint, fond look of reminiscence. I saw that film 6 times, he said. If you were looking for the murderer, arrest the director. Oh, no, it was excellent. Really, I loved it.
Just one little... Come on, we can sit over here, Chris interrupted him. She was pointing to the windowed breakfast nook. It had a waxed pine table and seat cushions covered in a flower pattern.
Yes, of course, the detective replied.
They sat down, and Chris handed him the calcium water.
Oh, yes, thank you, he said.
Don't mention it. Now, you were saying?
Oh, well, the film. It was lovely, really. So touching. But maybe just one little thing, the detective ventured. One tiny, almost minuscule flaw. Please believe me, in such matters, I'm only a layman, okay? I'm just audience, what do I know? However, it seemed to me the musical score was getting in the way of certain scenes. It was too intrusive.
Chris tried not to fidget with impatience as the detective went on earnestly, caught up in the rising ardor of his argument.
It kept reminding me that this was a movie, you know? Like so many of these fancy camera angles, so distracting. Incidentally, the score. The composer, did he steal it perhaps from Mendelssohn?
Chris had started drumming her fingertips lightly on the table, but now abruptly she stopped. What kind of detective was this, she wondered, and why was he constantly glancing to Carl? We don't call that stealing. We call it an homage, said Chris, smiling faintly. But I'm glad you liked the picture. Better drink that, she added with a nod at the glass of Kalsa water. Tends to get flat. Oh, yes, of course. I'm so garrulous. Forgive me. Lifting the glass as if in a toast, the portly detective drained its contents, his little finger arched up in the air demurely. Ah, good, that's good, he exhaled. As he set down the glass, his glance fell fondly on Reagan's sculpture of the bird. It was now the centerpiece of the table, its long beak floating mockingly above the salt and pepper shakers. It's so quaint, he said, smiling. So cute. He looked up at Chris. And the artist? My daughter. Very nice. Look, I hate to be... Yes, yes, I know, you're very busy. Listen, one or two questions and we're done, that's all. In fact, only one question, that's all. And then I'll be going. He was glancing at his wristwatch as if he were anxious to get away to some important appointment. Since poor Mr. Dennings, he began, had completed his filming in this area, we wondered if he might have been visiting someone on the night of the accident. Now, other than yourself, of course, did he have any friends in this area? Oh, he was here that night, Chris told him. Oh, really? The detective's eyebrows sickled upward. Near the time of the accident, he asked. Well, when did it happen? At 7:05 p.m. Yes, I think so. Well, that settles it then. The detective nodded, twisting in his chair as if preparatory to rising. He was drunk, he was leaving, he fell down the steps. Yep, that settles it, definitely. Listen, though, just for the sake of the record, can you tell me approximately what time he left the house? With a tilt of her head to the side, Chris appraised him with mild wonder. He was pawing at truth like a weary bachelor, pinching vegetables and fruit at a market. I don't know, she replied. I didn't see him. The detective looked puzzled. I don't understand. Well, he came and left while I was out. I was over at a doctor's office in Roslyn. The detective nodded. Ah, I see. Yes, of course. But then how did you know he was here? Oh, well, Sharon's at... Sharon, he interrupted. Yeah, Sharon Spencer. She's my secretary. Oh, she was here when Burke dropped by. He came to see her? No, he came to see me. Ah, yes. Go on, please. Forgive me for interrupting. My daughter was sick, and Sharon left him here while she went to pick up some prescriptions, and by the time I got home, Burke was gone. And what time was that? You remember? Chris shrugged and puckered her lips. Oh, maybe 7:15 or so, 7:30. And what time had you left the house? 6:15-ish. And what time had Miss Spencer left? I don't know. Between the time Miss Spencer left and the time you returned, who was here in the house with Mr. Dennings besides your daughter? Well, no one. No one. He left alone a sick child? Chris nodded, her expression blank. No servants? No. Willie and Carl. Who were Willie and Carl? Chris abruptly felt the earth shifting under her feet as the nuzzling interview, she realized, was suddenly a steely interrogation. Well, Carl's right there. Chris motioned with her head, her glance fixed dully on the manservant's back as he continued to clean and polish the oven. And Willie's his wife, Chris said. They're my housekeepers. Polishing. Why? The oven had been thoroughly cleaned and polished the night before. They'd taken the afternoon off, Chris continued, and when I got home, they weren't back yet. But when Willie... Chris paused, her eyes still fixed on Carl's back. Willie what? The detective prodded. Chris turned to him and shrugged. Oh, well, nothing, she said. She reached for a cigarette. Kinderman lit it. So then, only your daughter would know, he asked, when Burke Dennings left the house? It was really an accident? Oh, of course, it's, It's routine, Miss McNeil. Absolutely. Your friend Dennings wasn't robbed, and so what would be the motive?
Well, Burke could tick people off, Chris said somberly. Maybe someone at the top of the steps just hauled off and whacked him.
It's got a name, this kind of bird. I can't think of it. Something.
The detective was fingering Reagan's sculpture. Noticing Chris's steady stare, he took away his hand, looking vaguely embarrassed.
Oh, forgive me, you're busy. Well, a minute and we're done.
Now your daughter, she would know when Mr. Dennings left?
No, she wouldn't. She was heavily sedated.
Ah, a shame. Such a shame.
The detective's eyelids drooped with concern.
It's serious? He asked.
Yes.
I'm afraid it is.
May I ask? He had raised his hand in a delicate gesture.
We still don't know. Watch out for drafts, the detective said solemnly. A draft in the winter, when a house is hot as a magic carpet for bacteria. My mother used to say that. Maybe it's folk myth. Maybe. I don't know. But plainly speaking, to me, a myth is like a menu in a fancy French restaurant. It's glamorous, complicated camouflage for a fact you wouldn't otherwise swallow, like maybe the lima beans they're constantly giving you whenever you go out and order hamburger steak.
Chris felt herself loosening up. The odd, homey digression had relaxed her. The fuddled-looking, harmless St. Bernard dog had returned.
That's hers, Miss McNeil, your daughter's bedroom? The detective was pointing up at the ceiling.
The one with that big bay window looking out on those steps?
Chris nodded. Yeah, that's Reagan's. Keep the window closed and she'll get better.
Tense the moment before. Chris now had to struggle to keep from laughing.
Yes, I will, she said.
In fact, it's always closed and shuttered.
Yes, an ounce of prevention, the detective quoted sententiously.
He was dipping a pudgy hand into the inside pocket of his coat when his gaze fell on Chris's fingertips, again lightly drumming on the table.
Ah, yes, you're busy. Well, we're finished. Just a note for the record. Routine. That's it, and we're all done.
From the pocket of his coat, he'd extracted a crumpled mimeograph program of a high school production of Cyrano de Bergerac, and now he was groping in an outer pocket, retrieving a short yellow stub of a number 2 pencil, whose point had the look of having been sharpened with either a knife or the blade of a pair of scissors. Then, pressing the play program flat on the table and tamping out the wrinkles, he held the pencil stub over it and wheezed,
"Just a name or two, that's all, nothing more. Now,
that's Spencer with a C?"
"Yes, a C." "A C," the detective repeated, writing the name in a margin of the program.
"And the housekeepers, Joseph and Willie?"
"No, it's Carl and Willie Engstrom."
"Carl. Carl, yes, right, Carl Engstrom."
He scribbled the names in a dark, thick script. "Now, the times I remember," he breathed out huskily, while rotating the program in search of white space. "Oh, no, wait, no. Wait, I forgot. Yes, the housekeepers. Now, you said they got home at what time?"
"I didn't say."
"Carl, what time did you get in last night?" Chris called out to him.
The Swiss turned his head, inscrutable.
"I am home at exactly 9:30.
"Oh, yeah, that's right. You'd forgotten your key."
She turned her gaze back to the detective. "I remember I looked at the clock in the kitchen when I heard him ring the doorbell."
"You saw a good film?" the detective asked Carl.
"I never go by reviews," he said to Chris in a quiet aside. "It's what the people think, the audience."
"Paul Schofield in Lear,"
Carl informed the detective.
"Ah, I saw that. It was excellent."
"I see it at Gemini Theater," Carl continued. "The 6 o'clock showing. Then immediately after I take bus from in front of the theater, and please, that's not necessary," the detective protested as he held up a hand, palm outward.
No, please.
I don't mind, if you insist. I get off at Wisconsin Avenue and M Street. 9:20, I think. And then I walk to house. Look, you didn't have to tell me, the detective told him. But anyway, thank you. It was very considerate. By the way, you liked the film? It was good. Yes, yes, I thought so too. Exceptional. Well, now, he turned back to Chris and to scribbling on the program. I've wasted your time, but I have a job. That's the sad yin and yang of it, the whole deal. Oh, well, a moment and we're finished, he said reassuringly. Then, tragic, tragic, he added, as he jotted down fragments in margins. Such a talent, Burke Dennings. And a man who knew people, I'm sure, how to handle them, with so many who could make him look good or make him look bad, like the cameraman, the sound man, the composer, not to mention, forgive me, the actors. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me nowadays a director of importance has to be almost a psychologist with the cast. Am I wrong? No. No, you're not. Because we're all insecure. Even you? Mostly me. But Burke was good at that, keeping up your morale. Chris shrugged diffidently. Then, of course, he had one sweetheart of a temper. The detective repositioned the program. Ah, well, maybe so with the big shots, people his size. Once again, he was scribbling. But the key is the little people. The people who handle the minor details that if they didn't handle right would be major details, don't you think? Chris sighed her fingernails and shook her head. When Burke let fly, she said, he never discriminated. But it was only mean when he drank. All right, we're finished. We're done. Kinderman was dotting a final I when he abruptly remembered something. Oh, no, wait, the Engstroms. They went and they came together? No, Willie went to see a Beatles film, Chris answered, just as Carl was turning his head to reply. She got in a few minutes after I did. Well, why did I ask that, said Kinderman. Has nothing to do with anything. He folded up the program and tucked it away along with the pencil in the inside pocket of his coat. Well, that's that, he breathed out with satisfaction. When I'm back in the office, no doubt I'll remember something that maybe I should have asked. Yeah, with me, that always happens. Oh, well, whatever, he said. I could call you. He stood up and Chris got up with him. Well, I'm going out of town for a couple of weeks, she said. Oh, it can wait, the detective assured her. It can wait. He was staring at the sculpture with a smiling fondness again. Oh, so cute, so really, really cute. He'd leaned over and picked it up and was rubbing his thumb along the sculpted bird's beak, then replaced it on the table and started to leave. Have you got a good doctor, the detective asked, as Chris accompanied him toward the front door. I mean for your daughter. Well, I've sure got enough of them, Chris said glumly. Anyway, I'm checking her into a clinic that's supposed to be graded, doing what you do, only with viruses. Let's hope they're much better at it, Miss McNeil. It's out of town, this clinic? Yes, it is. It's in Ohio. It's a good one? We'll see. Keep her out of the draft. They had reached the front door of the house. Well, I would say that it's been a pleasure, the detective said gravely, while gripping his hat by the brim with both hands. But under the circumstances, he bent his head slightly and shook it, then looked back up. I'm so terribly sorry. Her arms folded across her chest. Chris lowered her head and said quietly, thank you. Thank you very much. Opening the door, the detective stepped outside, put on his hat, and turned back to look at Chris. Well, good luck with your daughter, he said. Chris smiled wanly. Good luck with the world. The detective nodded with a warmth and a sadness, then turned to his right and, short of breath,
slowly waddled away down the street. Chris watched as he listed toward a waiting squad car that was parked near the corner. He flung up a hand to his hat as a sudden gust of wind sprang sharply from the south and set the bottom of his long, floppy coat to flapping. Chris lowered her gaze and closed the door. When he'd entered the passenger side of the squad car, Kinderman turned and, looking back at the house, he thought he'd seen movement at Reagan's window, a quick, lithe figure moving quickly to the side and out of view. He wasn't sure. He had seen it peripherally, and so quickly, it was almost subliminal. He kept looking and noticed that the window shutters were open. Odd. Chris had told him they were always closed. For a time, the detective continued to watch. No one appeared. With a puzzled frown, the detective looked down and shook his head, and then he opened the glove compartment of the squad car, extracted a penknife and an evidence envelope, and unclasping the smallest of the blades of the knife, he held his thumb inside the envelope and extracted from under a thumbnail microscopic fragments of green-colored clay he'd surreptitiously scraped from Reagan's sculpture. Finished, he sealed up the envelope and placed it in the inside pocket of his coat. "Okay," he told his driver, "let's go." They pulled away from the curb, and as they drove down Prospect Street, Kinderman cautioned the driver, "Take it easy," as he noticed the traffic building up ahead. Then, lowering his head, he shut his eyes, and gripping the bridge of his nose with weary fingers, he breathed out despondently, "Oh, my God, what a world. What a life." Later that evening, while Dr. Klein was injecting Reagan with 50 milligrams of sparine to assure her tranquility on the journey to Dayton, Ohio, Kinderman stood brooding in his office with the palms of his hands pressed flat atop his desk as he pored over fragments of baffling data with no other light in the room but the narrow beam of an ancient desk lamp flaring brightly on a clutter of scattered reports. He believed that it helped him to narrow the focus of his concentration. His breathing was adenoidal and heavy in the darkness. His glance flitted here, now there, and then he took a deep breath and shut his eyes. "Mental clearance sale," he instructed himself, as he always did whenever he wished to tidy up his brain for a fresh point of view. "Absolutely everything must go." Then he opened his eyes and re-examined the pathologist's report on Dennings. Tearing of the spinal cord with fractured skull and neck, plus numerous contusions, lacerations, and abrasions, stretching of the neck skin, ecchymosis of the neck skin, shearing of the platysma, sternomastoid, splenius, trapezius, and various smaller muscles of the neck, with fracture of the spine and of the vertebrae, and shearing of both the anterior and posterior spinous ligaments. He looked out a window at the dark of the city. The Capitol dome light glowed in signal that the Congress was working late, and once again the detective shut his eyes, recalling his conversation with the district pathologist at 11:55 p.m. on the night of Denning's death.
"It could have happened in the fall?"
"Oh, well, it's very unlikely. The sternomastoids and the trapezius muscles alone are enough to prevent it. Then you've also got the various articulations of the cervical spine to be overcome, as well as the ligaments holding the bones together."
"Speaking plainly, however, Doctor, is it possible?"
"Well, yes. The man was drunk, and these muscles were doubtless somewhat relaxed. Perhaps if the force of the initial impact was sufficiently powerful..."
"Falling maybe 30-40 feet before he hit?"
"Well, yes, that. And if immediately after impact
his head got stuck in something. In other words, if there were immediate interference with the normal rotation of the head and the body as a unit, well, I don't know, maybe. As I say, just maybe, you could get this result.
Could another human being have done it?
Oh, yes. But he'd have to be an exceptionally powerful man. Kinderman had checked Carl Engstrom's story regarding his whereabouts at the time of Denning's death. The show times matched, as did the schedule that night, of a DC transit bus. Moreover, the driver of the bus that Carl had claimed he had boarded near the front of the theater went off duty at Wisconsin and M Streets, where Carl had stated he'd alighted at approximately 20 minutes after 9. A change of drivers had taken place, and the off-duty driver had logged the time of his arrival at the transfer point, precisely 9:18. Yet on Kinderman's desk was a record of a felony charge against Engstrom on August 27, 1963, alleging he had stolen a quantity of narcotics over a period of months from the home of a doctor in Beverly Hills, where he and Willie were then employed. Born April 21st in Zurich, Switzerland, married to Willie Nee Braun, September 7, 1941, daughter Elvira, born New York City, January 11th, 1943, current address unknown, defendant. The remainder of the report the detective found baffling. The doctor, whose testimony was deemed a sine qua non for successful prosecution, abruptly and without explanation, dropped the charges. Why had he done so? And as the Engstroms had been hired by Chris McNeil only 2 months later, the doctor had given them a favorable reference. Why would he do so? Engstrom had certainly pilfered the drugs, and yet a medical examination at the time of the charge had failed to yield the slightest sign that the man was an addict or even a user. Why not? With his eyes still closed, the detective softly recited the beginning of the Lewis Carroll poem, Jabberwocky. 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. It was another of Kinderman's mind-clearing tricks. And when he had finished the recitation, he opened his eyes and fixed his gaze on the Capitol Rotunda. He was trying to keep his mind a blank, although, as usual, he found the task impossible. Sighing, he glanced at the police psychologist's report on the recent desecrations at Holy Trinity Church. Statue. Phallus, human excrement, Damien Karras. He had underscored in red. His breathing slightly whistling in the total silence, he reached for a scholarly work on witchcraft and turned to a page that he had marked with a paper clip. Black Mass, a form of devil worship, the ritual consisting in the main of 1. Exhortation, the sermon, to performance of evil among the community. 2. Coition with the demon, reputedly painful, the demon's penis invariably described as icy cold. And 3. A variety of desecrations that were largely sexual in nature. For example, communion hosts of unusual size were prepared, compounded of flour, feces, menstrual blood, and pus, which then were slit and used as artificial vaginas with which the priests would ferociously copulate while raving that they were ravishing the Virgin Mother of God or that they were sodomizing Christ. In another instance of such practice, a statue of Christ was inserted deep in a girl's vagina while into her anus was inserted the host, which the priest then crushed as he shouted blasphemies and sodomized the girl.
Life-sized images of Christ and the Virgin Mary also played a frequent role in the ritual. The image of the Virgin, for example, usually painted to give her a dissolute, sluttish appearance, was equipped with breasts which the cultists sucked, and also a vagina into which the penis might be inserted. The statues of Christ were equipped with a phallus for fellatio by both the men and the women, and also for insertion into the vagina of the women and the anus of the men. Occasionally, rather than an image, a human figure was bound to a cross and made to function in place of the statue, and upon the discharge of his semen, it was collected in a blasphemously consecrated chalice and used in the making of the communion host, which was destined to be consecrated on an altar covered with excrement. Kinderman flipped the pages to an underlined paragraph dealing with ritualistic murder, reading it slowly a while, nibbling at the pad of an index finger. And when he had finished, he frowned at the page and shook his head, then lifted a brooding glance to the lamp. He flicked it off and left his office. He drove to the morgue. The young attendant at the desk was munching at a ham and cheese sandwich on rye and was brushing the crumbs from a crossword puzzle as Kinderman approached him. "Dennings," the detective breathed out hoarsely. The attendant nodded, hastily filled in a 5-letter horizontal, then rose with his sandwich and moved down the hall. "Down this way," he said laconically. Kinderman trailed him, hat in hand, following the faint scent of caraway seed and mustard to rows of refrigerated lockers, to the dreamless cabinet used for the filing of sightless eyes. They halted at locker 32. The expressionless attendant slid it out. He bit at his sandwich, and a fragment of mayonnaise-speckled crust fell lightly to the graying shroud. Kinderman stared, and then, slowly and gently, he pulled back the sheet to expose what he'd seen and yet could not accept. Denning's head was turned completely around and facing backwards.